Chapter 6. The Makers of Fire. The cub came across it suddenly. It was his own fault. He had been careless. He had left the cave and run down to the stream to drink. Suddenly in front of him, sitting silently on the ground, were five live things, things that he had never seen before. It was his first glimpse of mankind. But at the sight of him, the five Indians did not spring to their feet, nor show their teeth, nor snarl. They did not move, but sat there, silent and threatening. Nor did the cub move. Every instinct of his nature would have made him run wildly away if he had not felt a new, very different instinct, a great awe. He had never seen man, yet his instinct told him that here was mastery and power, something far beyond him. His instinct made him recognize in man the animal that had fought its way to be above all the other animals of the wild. And so he cowered down, paralyzed with fear, almost ready to submit. One of the Indians rose, walked over to him, and bent over him. The cub cowered closer to the ground. His hair bristled on his back, and he pulled his lips back and showed his little fangs. The man spoke.
"Look at his white fangs," he said.
The other Indians laughed loudly and told the man to pick the cub up. As the man's hand came closer and closer, the cub experienced two great instincts, to yield and to fight. So he did both. He yielded until the hand almost touched him. Then he fought, snapping his teeth into the hand. The next moment, he received a hit on the head that knocked him over on his side. Then all the fight left him, but the man whose hand he had bitten was angry. The cub received a hit on the other side of his head, and he sat up and yelped. The other four Indians laughed more loudly, and even the man who had been bitten began to laugh. They surrounded the cub and laughed at him, while he yelped in pain and fear. In the middle of it, he heard something. The Indians heard it too. The cub knew what it was, and he stopped his yelping and waited for his mother, his fierce mother, who fought and killed all things and was never afraid. She had heard the cry of her cub and was running to save him, snarling as she ran. The cub leaped happily to meet her, while the man-animals quickly took several steps backwards. The she-wolf stood over her cub, facing the men, snarling, her hair bristling. Then one of the men gave a strong, sharp cry.
"Kitcha!"
The cub saw his fearless mother lie down on the ground, whimpering, wagging her tail, making peace signs. The cub could not understand. He was horrified. The man who had spoken came over to her. He put his hand upon her head. She did not snap nor threaten to snarl. The other men came up and surrounded her and felt her, and she did not try to stop them. The men were very excited. The cub sat near his mother, still bristling from time to time, but doing his best to submit.
"It's a year since she ran away, Grey Beaver,"
said an Indian called Salmon Tongue.
"Yes," the other Indian replied. "It was a time of great famine, and there was no meat for the dogs. We had to set Keetcha free. She belonged to my brother, and now he is dead, she belongs to me."
"She has lived with the wolves,"
said a third Indian.
"So it would seem, Three Eagles,"
Grey Beaver answered.
"And here is the evidence."
He pointed to the cub, who immediately began to snarl again, showing his sharp white teeth.
"I shall call him White Fang."
Grey Beaver took a knife, went into the trees and cut a stick. White Fang watched him. The Indian made a cut in each end of the stick, and in the cuts he tied strings of animal skin. He tied one string around Kitcha's throat. Then he led her to a small pine, around which he tied the other string. White Fang followed and lay down beside her. Salmon Tongue rolled him over on his back. Kitcha watched anxiously. But Salmon Tongue rubbed White Fang's stomach playfully and rolled him from side to side. White Fang felt ridiculous and helpless. Like this, he could do nothing to defend himself. Soon he even began to enjoy what was being done to him. When the man finally left him alone and went away, he was no longer afraid. After a time, White Fang left Kitcher's side and began to crawl away cautiously. Kitcher watched, but she could not follow him. In front of White Fang was Grey Beaver, doing something with sticks and dry moss spread on the ground. White Fang came close to him and watched. Grey Beaver did not seem hostile, so White Fang, still filled with curiosity, came closer till he touched Grey Beaver's knee. He saw something appear among the sticks, a live thing the color of the sun in the sky. White Fang knew nothing about fire. It attracted him as the light in the mouth of the cave had attracted him in his early days. His nose touched the flame, and at the same instant his little tongue went out into it. For a moment he was paralyzed. Then he jumped backwards, yelping. At the noise, Kitcher leaped snarling, furious because she could not come to help him. Grey Beaver laughed loudly and told the rest of the camp what had happened until everybody was laughing. But White Fang sat there and yelped, a sad, pitiable little figure among all the man-animals. It was the worst hurt he had ever known. He cried and cried, and at every cry, the man-animals burst out laughing again. He tried to lick his nose with his tongue, but the tongue was burnt too, and the two hurts coming together produced greater hurt, and he cried even more. Then he felt shame, shame that the man-animals were laughing at him, and he turned and fled, not from the hurt of the fire, but from the laughter, which hurt him even more. He fled to Kitcher, who was jumping angrily at the end of her string, to Kitcher, the one creature in the world who was not laughing at him. Night came, and White Fang lay by his mother's side. His nose and tongue still hurt, but worse than that, he was homesick. He wanted the peace and quiet of the stream and the cave. There were so many of the man-animals, all making noises, and there were the Indians' other dogs, quarreling and fighting. He watched the man-animals moving about the camp and wondered again at their superiority and mastery. They were fire-makers. To him, they were gods.